بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الحمد لله وكفى وسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى. أما بعد، فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. سبحان الذي أسرى بعبده ليلا من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى الذي باركنا حوله لنريه من آياتنا إنه هو السميع البصير. صدق الله العظيم. Assalamu alaikum, my dear respected friends and elders in Islam. Today's talk is going to be titled The Nakba. And unfortunately, I can be certain that most of the brothers would not know what I'm talking about. Yet the catastrophes of the non-Muslims in the name of Holocaust, everybody would know what I'm talking about. Yet if I say the Nakba, more than half maybe, Allahu Alam, but would not know what I'm saying. And this is the depth of our ignorance. And I'm not trying to say something that just because I know this particular fact, and I only got to know about it just recently as well. My ignorance I'm highlighting to you first and foremost. It is because we are engulfed in a system, in particular an education system, that promotes the disasters of other communities above and beyond ours. And we are engulfed in this system, and therefore we are not aware of the disasters and the consequences that are faced by Muslim communities up and down the world. In our last gathering, we talked about immediately after the UN resolution was passed to petition Palestine in 1947, and the civil disturbance that took place up until 14th of May, when the Zionists decided to claim upon the land of Palestine their state of Israel. Immediately thereafter, a conventional war broke out. So from a civil war, we have a conventional war that takes place between the Zionist entity, now what is called as Israel. And I'll use the word Israel because it becomes easy for us to understand. It is not because we accept the regime or any of that nature. Immediately, what happens is the United Nations commission a person called Khan Fouk Benatot to take over and try and resolve the issue between the Arabs and the Palestinians. Now, Fouk Benatot was a Swede and he was a very compassionate man. In fact, during the Second World War, he helped over 20,000 Jews escape Hitler's concentration camp. So the Zionists were very happy at this because they had somebody who was compassionate to them, a track record of being good to the Jewish people, was being appointed by the United Nations to solve the conflict between the Israelis, the Zionists, and the Arabs. However, when Benedict looked at the issue, he said that a great injustice is being carried out by the Israelis. And he proposed two things, the first of which was to say that all the Palestinians who have been evicted from their homes, as we had looked at Dar Yassin, they should be allowed to go back. Those who do not wish to go back must be compensated for the loss of material. And his statement, Count Bernadotte's, is it would be an offense against the principle of elementary justice if these innocent Palestinian victims of the conflict were denied the right of return to their homes, while Jewish immigration flow into Palestine, and indeed at least offer the threat of permanent replacement of the Arab refugees who have been rooted in the land for centuries. Immediately after Benedict's declaration of statement, the very next day, which was the 17th of September, the Zionists murdered him. The person who killed him, and this person had saved 20,000 Jews from Hitler's concentration camp. Zionists kill him. Why? For saying that the Palestinians have a right of return. A great injustice is being taken place here. The person who killed him was the head of the Stern Gang by a person named called Friedman. And Friedman was awarded by the Israeli public by electing him to their parliament in 1950, and he became the Knesset member of Parliament of Israel. This shows the psychology of the Israeli public for what we would term as terrorists. Now, the Israeli war of 1948 and 49 is portrayed by the Zionists and mystified into legends as a battle between Goliath, the bad Arabs, the big muscular people on one side, with little David on the other. An innocent nation was trying to defend itself. And all these Arab countries, four or five Arab countries, we had Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, trying to take them all. This is the myth. And this, I can use a word, the strongest word I've used so far, was total rubbish. If you look at the statistics, it's amazing. Benny Morris, who's at the present a lecturer at Ben Gurion University, he's a Zionist, and he states, at the beginning of the war, that's very early 47, 48, during that time, the Jewish army was 65,000. The Arab total Arab army of 28,000. By the end of the war, by 49, the Zionist army had grown to 115,000 to the Arab army of only 40,000. On top of this disparity, the Jewish army was well trained, which we looked at during the Second World War by the British. They had an armament supply in abundance from Britain, from America, and a very big consignment which they bought from Czechoslovakia. The Western world, America and Britain, at that time put a sanction against supplying arms to the Middle East. This sanction worked against the Arabs because the Zionists had already got their arms, and the Arab people were left without any arms. They had an infrastructure that the Arab countries did not have. They had a motive. They wanted to establish something which the Arabs did not have. They were not, the Palestinian land was not per se a concern of the Egyptian, neither was it a concern for the Jordanians or the Iraqis. Okay. So we have a great disparity on motives here as well. The only Arab army that was trained or was sufficiently strong enough was the Arab Legion. Now the Arab Legion was the only part of the army, and it was the smallest part. Was based in Amman. It was directly under the control of King Abdullah, who, as we remember last time, was placed in Amman from the Hijaz by the British. Okay? And Amman was in control of London. The general of the Arab Legion was a person called John Glubb. So now hopefully you can understand what is going on here. John Glubb was the commander of the Arab Legion. And it is amazing to show you the disunity. I would just like to give you one example, because there's so many I can give you. I'll give you the example of Amman, what happened. King Abdullah was in secret talks with the Zionists. And Golda Meir, in her diaries, revealed that she met, Golda Meir became, by the way, the Prime Minister of Israel later on. She met King Abdullah twice before the 1947 war. And King Abdullah was the opinion that he would accept petition, the UN petition, but with one proviso. What he wanted was the half that the Zionists were given, they can have, but the other half should go to Jordan, and he should become the ruler of this area. Why? Because the other half of the petition contained Masjid al-Aqsa Haramain. Because he was denied access to the two holy sites of Mecca and Medina, and he could not be the custodian of holy sites, to legitimize his kingdom, to legitimize his premiership, he wanted to have Al-Aqsa Haramain and become the leader of this mosque so that he could claim his authority upon the greater Muslim Ummah. And therefore, his position becomes of importance in the eyes of the Muslims. Purely a political motive. In order to sideline the Palestinians, he did whatever he could. And as I said earlier, the Arab Legion was in his hands. John Glubb, in his diary, who's the general of the Arab Legion, states, and it is amazing what he leaves in his diary, King Abdullah told him on the day before the war, the day before the Arab Legion entered Palestine stroke Israel now, that the Jews are too strong and it is a mistake to make a war against them. This is the advice of King Abdullah to John Glubb. When a Palestinian contingency, a small section of a Palestinian contingency, managed to occupy part of West Jerusalem, okay, the part where the Zionists were the strongest, they managed to occupy a certain area. They came under heavy fire, so they rang John Glubb and the Arab Legion to send assistance so that they could solidify their position. No assistance came. The Palestinians had to retreat. Okay. And this, my friends, is a classic example. And this is repeated with Egypt. Egypt was not concerned. As long as the Zionists did not occupy part of Egyptian territory, they did not mind. And this is how Israel managed to wipe out 513 Palestinian villages. How many? 513. 700,000 Palestinians were made refugees. They were forced out of their houses from gunpoint. They were pushed out from the territory where they had lived for over 10,000 years. This catastrophe of the Palestinians is called the Nakba. This is what is termed as the Nakba. This is the Palestinian catastrophe, the Muslims' catastrophe of the Holy Land. Now, to show you the disdain between the Arabs and what they were playing, the politics they were playing within themselves, it's amazing. Now King Abdullah, to stamp authority over the West Bank and Masjid al-Aqsa, convened a meeting in Amman, and he produced what was known as the First Palestinian Congress and appointed a leader to look over the affairs of the Palestinians. A few days earlier, the Egyptians had started the established the old Palestinian government in Gaza. So they have now they established two Palestinian organizations within days. At what time? When the Zionists are attacking them. They are playing politics amongst themselves. And all what for? They were using Masjid al-Aqsa and the Palestinian issue so that they themselves, the Arab, and I'm using Arab here very selectively, I'm not using Muslim leaders, because these leaders were nationalists. They did not have much, they were not concerned with the Ummah. They were more concerned with establishing their own nationhood states. Therefore, they are purely nationalists. These Arab leaders were more concerned for using the Palestinian issue and Masjid al-Aqsa as a tool to solidify their own position in their own country. So much so that in December 1949, King Abdullah convened a meeting and declared himself as the King of Palestine. And he became the custodian of what we call the West Bank and wherein is Masjid al-Aqsa Haramain. And Masjid al-Aqsa became in direct control of King Abdullah or of Jordan. Now, while this was going on within the Arabs, the Israelis were making hay as normal and they were consolidating their position. They used two laws and they tried to legitimize this. They called themselves democracy. Israeli democracy is the same as the American democracy of the time of Washington, where they said all men are equal, except if you are black, then you can be a slave, or a red Indian, if you kill, it doesn't matter. Israeli democracy is a democracy only for the Jews, not for the Palestinians. If you're a Palestinian, anything can be done to you. It does not matter. Two laws that they passed immediately. One was the law of return. Now, we touched the law of return in the very first talk I gave you. The law of return was basically any Jew anywhere in the world has a right to come in and settle in occupied Palestine, which they are now called Israel. And a definition of a Jew was anybody who was born to a Jewish woman, not a father, but a mother. So if you have a Jewish woman and you have a child, it doesn't matter who that woman is married to, you become an Israeli citizen automatically. And if you recall, according to this law, Israeli law of return, Sulaiman al-Islam will not be allowed to go back to Israel because Sulaiman al-Islam's mother was a Hittite. Beersheba, according to their books, not our books, according to their books, I'm giving you reference, Beersheba was a Hittite. Therefore, Sulaiman al-Islam was a Hittite, not a Jew. And now they want to replace Masjid al-Aqsa with Sulaiman al-Islam's temple. Contradiction in terms here? I'll leave it to you to solve this issue. But this is a racist law. And that is why the UN resolution passed a law to state that Zionism is racism. I'll give you an example of why it's racist. Apart from the simple fact that a Palestinian who were born there for years, who lived there, who can trace their generations to thousands of years back, were now denied the right to live in Palestine because of this law. Yet a Jew who was born in, say, Russia, who had never been to Palestine, whose parents had never been to Palestine, now had a right to come to Palestine and live there. Besides this, if there were two brothers, say in London, they married two women in London. One of them happens to be Palestinian, one of them happens to be a Jew. The person who marries a Jewish woman has a right to go to Palestine. But the person who marries a Palestinian, he has no right to go there. Therefore, this law becomes a racist law, and it's open. Zionism is racism. There is no doubt about this. And this racism is similar to the racism of apartheid South Africa. In fact, it is worse. Those people, a lot of people from Africa here, who've seen apartheid South Africa, now go to occupied Palestine. The apartheid that is practiced by the Israelis is 100 times worse. The second law they passed is called the land law. Now, the land laws, there were several land laws. One of them was inherited from the British, which was basically the Israeli military army could designate any area under the pretext of security and evict the Palestinians from that area. So they would designate a certain area to say, this area, because of security, we cannot allow you to farm. Therefore, you cannot enter this area. A Palestinian cannot enter this area. A Palestinian, if he tried to enter this area or cultivate the land, he would be shot at, literally. Okay. As soon as a Palestinian stopped cultivating that land or using that land, the Ministry of Agriculture, Israeli Ministry of Agriculture, would go to the High Court and say, the Palestinians are not using this land, therefore we want it for ourselves. And they would take it. And they have taken thousands of acres, not hundreds, thousands of acres of Palestinian land under this law. The second law they use is called the law of absentee. What this law does is if during the war period, 47, 48, 49, if a Palestinian was not present on his land while the Israelis came there, or if a Palestinian cannot prove the citizenship of Israel, which they cannot get anywhere because he's not a Jew, it's almost contradictory in terms here, but this is what they actually say. That land becomes the land of the state of Israel, and they take it. And using this means, they have confiscated the whole of the Palestinian land. They've covered, as I said, they made 700,000 people refugees. 530 villages were destroyed. As many or twice as many masajids were destroyed. Even Muslim cemeteries were not spared. In fact, the Hilton Hotel today standing in Tel Aviv was built on a Muslim cemetery, a recorded site. So many masajids today, if you go into Palestine, especially the occupied Palestine of 1948, you will see converted into discotheques, social clubs, factory units, and so forth. You can see the gumbats, you can see the minaret in some places, they're still there. You can recognize the building as a masajid, but they're converted into something else. And this happened primarily because not of the strength of the Israelis, but because of the rivalry between the Arab states. And they did not really want the Palestinians to have their own state. The Arab world did not want this. While this was carrying on, after the war, the next war that takes place is in 1967. This 1967 war is also known as the Six-Day War. The Israelis did not sit as comfortably and be content with what they had occupied or what they had destroyed. They carry on with three things. First, massacring the Palestinians and expelling as many Palestinians as possible. Secondly, to intimidate the Arab countries, neighboring Arab countries, and to vie against each other. The third thing they did is they tried to make the Arab countries look in the international eye, especially Britain and in Americans' eyes, as backward countries and countries that were against the democracy and the norms of Western culture. Basically, they wanted the Western world to view Arabs as bigoted and as backward. And I'll hopefully go through all these three points, how they did this. With the Palestinians themselves first. Several massacres took place between the first war in 1947, 48, 49, and 67. One of the biggest massacres that took place is the massacre of Kibia. Sharon, with his commander unit called Unit 101, entered the village of Kibia in the middle of the night. They destroyed in the same way as the massacre of Dar Yassin. The same thing happens against the village of Kibia. They killed every individual person in that village. Not only that, but they destroyed all the farm animals. The masajid was dynamited, and so was the school. A Time magazine reporter who stated the report in the Time magazine stated, Sharon's soldiers shot every man, woman, and child they could find. The reporter carries on and says, the screaming of the dying could be heard amidst the explosion. This was Sharon's first recorded massacre. UN resolution was passed against this massacre as genocide. This was in 1953, 14th of October. At that time, I just want you to, what even the own Israelis think of this massacre. The acting prime minister of the time of Israel was Moshe Shiraz. The day before the massacre, he states in his diaries that I told Levine that this attack will be a grave error and recalled citing various precedents that it was never proved the reprisal actions served their declared purposes. Levine smiled at Shiraz and kept to his own idea. Ben Gurion, he said, didn't share my views. This is the Prime Minister of Israel talking. On the 16th of October, 2 days after the massacre, he states, I must underline that when I opposed the actions, I did not even remotely suspect such a bloodbath. On the 18th, he again comes to his diaries and states, in the cabinet meeting, I condemned the Kibya affair that exposed us in front of the whole world as a gang of bloodsuckers. This is the Israeli Prime Minister talking about Sharon and about himself, about the Israelis as bloodsuckers. Thereafter, there was a lot of other massacres. There was Kafr Qasim massacre. There used to be a curfew. And what the Israelis did, the curfew used to start at 6 o'clock in the evening and finish at about 8 or 6 in the morning the next day. And this particular day, they arrived at Kafr Qasim village, and they said, today's curfew will start at 4 o'clock. Now, the villagers had gone out to farm in their farmyards, and the curfew began. As soon as the curfew started, obviously, the villagers, the people who were working in their farms started to return home. Because they were returning home after the curfew hours, they got shot at and they killed hundreds. And Israeli excuse, they broke the curfew. The curfew that they imposed an hour before, people were innocent. And they used these tactics over and over again to justify the destruction and the murder of the Palestinians. On the international affair, to discredit the Arabs, what did they do? The amazing affair, the Levine affair of 1952. What the Israelis did is they recruited Egyptian Jews to bomb the British embassy in Cairo, the American embassy in Cairo, and all the centers that were frequented by the Westerners. And they made it look as if the Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the Islamic Brotherhood of Egypt, was doing this. So that in the international eyes, the Muslims, and in particular Egypt, looks bad, and therefore the international world stopped supporting the Arabs. Fortunately, they were exposed. The Egyptian Jews were caught, but only after the explosion had taken place, mind you. And Nasser, no, it wasn't Nasser, sorry, this was before Nasser, just before Nasser. The Egyptian government hung the Jews. Now, in Israel, they concocted the story and said, this shows the hatred of the Arabs against the Jews. Look at what Egypt has done. It was not until 1961, I think, that Israel accepted the responsibility of planting the Egyptian Jews to do this work. All this period, they used their masses to whip up hatred for the Arabs. And to just give you an example of what Sharad wrote in his diaries again, he quotes Moshe Dayan, and to show you an Israeli ideology and mindset, Moshe Dayan stated as follows, that Israel must see the sword as the main, if not the only, instrument with which to keep its moral and high to retain its moral tensions. Towards this end, it may, and cancels that and says, no, it must invent dangers. And to do this, it must adopt the method of provocation and then revenge. And above all, let us hope for a new war with the Arab countries, so that we may finally get rid out of troubles and acquire space for ourselves. So Israel, as early as the 1950s, was looking for a war, an excuse to have a war with the Arab countries. What happened next? Honestly, if this was not in the main history textbooks, it would be difficult to believe, and you have to pinch yourself. This is the stuff of almost conspiracy theories. Nasser, as soon as he became the Prime Minister of Egypt in 1956, he nationalized the Suez Canal. Now, Suez Canal, up until then, was in the hands of the British. When Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, the Western countries, especially France and Britain, were concerned whether he would close the strait for them to use to transfer their goods, basically. So what they did is Britain called up a meeting between Britain, France, and Israel. They met in Paris. Ben Gurion, Mole, who was the Prime Minister of France at the time, and Selwyn Lloyd of Britain. And this is amazing. These are the leaders of the Western world and Israel. They sat down on the table and decided to occupy Egypt, and in particular, Suez Canal. Can you believe this? They actually sat down on a table to have a conference to say that because Nasser has nationalized the Suez Canal, we must take it over from him. And the plan was Israel must attack Egypt and go up to the Suez Canal. And they knew the strength of Egypt, or its weaknesses rather. And they knew that Israel would go very close to the Suez Canal. When Israel does this, France and Britain would run to the aid of Egypt and tell the Egyptians, look at the Israelis, if you don't allow us to help you, they will occupy your whole country. So let us help you and stop the Israeli advance. So Britain and France would go on the other side of the Suez Canal and secure the Suez Canal for themselves. The plan was set. And as I said, if this was not in the major textbook, you would think this is a conspiracy. But it is available in every historical book of the Middle East of this era. In November, in November of 1954, Israel attacked Egypt. But the Egyptians were weaker than what they anticipated. Within a day and a half, the Israeli army had reached the Suez Canal. This quick advance stalled Britain's and France's plan, because British army was stationed at Malta and they were traveling by ship. By the time Britain dropped its paratroopers and could go and rush to the Egyptians to help them, the United Nations intervened with Russia and America. The British were exposed, and the French Prime Minister and even the British Prime Minister immediately, they lost the next election. I think one of them had to actually resign because of the international community and their plan of terrorism. That is the only word you can use. The terrorist plan was exposed and they were open to the world. What this single incident showed, that this was, if any one incident you can pick up in the British colonialist power, this incident indicated the end of the British colonialist power in the world, because they no longer remain a colonialist entity, and America now takes over from the, and now becomes what, the superpower of the world. But this event was amazing, and this weaknesses of Arab to show that in 1.5 day an Israeli army can move and take over and come up to the Suez Canal. In fact, the French paratroopers were dropped at Port Said, and they were only 100 miles from taking over the whole of Suez Canal. But as I said, the UN intervened, and because of the friction at that time between Russia and America, and that was the main reason that Britain could not manage to take over. So this is the second and third tactic we talked about, how Israel used to undermine the Arabs. Even while this was going on, it is amazing, the Arabs were still fighting amongst each other. Between 1957 and 1967, the war of 1967, the Israelis were consolidating and solidifying their position. They were winning not only friends, Western friends, but within Palestine, they were destroying any little Palestinian resistance that existed. Whereas the Arabs, they had a rivalry between them. And he says, this era between 57 and 67 is dominant with Arab rivalries. There are two schemes. And I'm sorry to go in depth in this, but we need to understand why the Palestinians did not succeed in having their own land from an entity that is not only alien, but was foreign and was new to a land. How it was possible with all these Arab countries, 100 million, 200 million, as general population, although the army was very small, how they managed to lose the Holy Land and Masjid al-Aqsa al-Haramain. There were two schemes taking place. There was one scheme called the Fertile Crescent Scheme, and within this were Jordan, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, and they were backed by America. On the other side was the United Arab Nations League, which was Egypt and Syria. What happened was America and the CIA wanted to topple over the Syrian government because it was allied with the Russians. At the time, Russia was communist, and all of us, alhamdulillah, yes, can still remember the friction between communism and capitalism. They used the Iraqis to topple over the Syrians. And this was in early 57. They failed, the CIA plot was exposed, and CIA actually admitted being the Crescent Scheme. And within this, Jordan, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, and they were backed by America. On the other side was the United Arab Nations League, which was Egypt and Syria. What happened was America and the CIA wanted to topple over the Syrian government because it was allied with the Russians. At the time, Russia was communist, and all of us, alhamdulillah, yes, can still remember the friction between communism and capitalism. They used the Iraqis to topple over the Syrians. And this was in early 57. They failed, the CIA plot was exposed, and CIA actually admitted doing it. A month later, they tried it again. Again, they got exposed, and the plan was spoiled. However, for the Syrians now, they felt in danger. So they approached Egypt, and at the time Nasser now becomes the leader of Egypt, to become the leader of Syria and Egypt and create a republic, United Arab Republic, between Syria and Egypt. A republic was proclaimed in February 1958, and this republic lasted for 3 years, United Arab Republic, and this country is basically Egypt and Syria. However, instead of uniting the two countries, by the end, within 3 years, they had become such great enemies that they had to get rid of whatever Egyptian presence was in Syria. So a great rivalry now exists between Syria and Egypt. Iraqis, again, had a problem with the Syrians, and Saudi Arabia, with regard to Yemen. Yemen, there was a civil war in Yemen between the Islamists and the nationalists. Saudi Arabia was supporting the Islamists, Nasser was supporting the nationalists. So Egypt had a problem with Saudi Arabia, had a problem with Syria, had a problem with Iraq. At one stage, Iraq had a problem with Syria as well, and Egypt. All these problems within the Arab world was taking place. And this is just pre-1964. In 1964, the PLO was formed by Nasser in Gaza. At the same time, and the first leader of the PLO, for reference point, was Ahmad al-Shukairi. The Syrians established Fatah. And Yasser Arafat and Khalil al-Wazir, who was known as Abu Jihad, who got murdered in Tunisia, were the main people in the Fatah. They merged later on, but initially they were really created as rival groups. Again, the Arab states are trying to use the Palestinians to consolidate their position. But at no time during this phase, during the phase of 48 to 67, were any Palestinians allowed to operate from Arab soil. That means no Palestinian from either Egypt, Jordan, or Syria was allowed to operate and try and occupy their own land that has been occupied by the Zionists. They were restricted. So much so that the Ikhwan al-Muslimin, Hassan al-Banna, who was the leader of Ikhwan al-Muslimin in Egypt, was assassinated because he raised at one point 100,000 people for the Egyptian army to go and reconquer the Palestinian land and Masjid al-Aqsa. And the Egyptians killed him. This was the government that did it. A lot of leading ulamas and Ikhwan brothers in Egypt were killed. During the 67 wars, I just remembered one incident. A Bosnian Mujahideen group came there to help the Palestinians. These Mujahideen were given guns that exploded in their faces. This is reference. It is amazing. You should remember that Arabs were absolutely indoctrinated with nationhood. They did not care about Ummah. They did not care about the Palestinians. And as King Abdullah's example I gave you, all they were using the Palestinian issue was to consolidate their own position in their own country. That's all. And they used the Palestinian issue. And they had an amazing slogan. They used to say that, in almost obnoxious, I think it was something like, in unity we shall liberate. So unite with us and we will liberate Palestine. So you should have no dissent within the country. Nobody should criticize the leaders. And unity was called for from the public so that it could liberate the Palestinians. Yet they would not allow any Palestinians to operate and try and liberate themselves, either themselves or use the general public, the people who are prepared, especially the Muslims, the Islamists, who are prepared to fight for the Palestinians to work from their territories. Within this atmosphere, the Six-Day War erupts. Again, the Six-Day War is a great myth. The greatest myth is Israel was minding its own business, doing about, you know, living in the Mediterranean breeze, and the Arabs attacked them. In particular, the Israelis, the Zionists, will cite that there was two contingency of Egyptian armor that was a tank that was moving within the Sinai that prompted the Israelis to attack them and try and consolidate their position. If you again look at the facts, totally different. I would like to quote you the Israelis themselves, the Israeli leaders, and listen to this regarding the 1967 war. This is the former commander of Air Force General Isa Witzman. He states that the attack on Egypt, Jordan, and Syria was justified so that Israel could exist according to the scale, spirit, and the quality she now embodies. This is a commander of the Israeli army. Menachem Begin, in 1967, he states, "We had a choice. The Egyptian army, which I spoke about, concentration in the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves." This is Begin stating. "We decided to attack him." Moshe Dayan, who became a hero from this 1967 war, he states regarding how the war started with the Syrians. He's saying that many of the firefighters with the Syrians were deliberately provoked by Israel. The kibbutzim residents who pressed the government to take over the Golan Heights, and this is how they did it. They didn't even try to hide their greed for the land. We would send a tractor to plow in some area which was designated as militarized and knew in advance that the Syrians would start to shoot. If they didn't shoot, if the Syrians did not shoot at our tractors, we would tell the tractors to advance even further until the Syrians would get annoyed and shoot. And when they shoot, we used to use artillery and air force. And that is how it was. The Syrians, on the fourth day of the war, this is Moshe Dayan stating, were not a threat to us. General Rabin, who was the chief of staff in 1967, finally, I stated, "I do not think Nasser wanted a war. The two divisions he sent to Sinai on May the 14th would not have been sufficient to launch an offensive against Israel. He knew it, and we knew it." Anybody want a reference for this? It's Righteous Victims, a book called Righteous Victims. This 1967 war. Israel deliberately provoked the Arab world, and the Arab world was sleeping. All the air forces, the Egyptian, the Syrian, the Jordanian were on the ground. They flattened them. And the only thing that was left for the Israelis then to do is to move into the area. They occupied from Sinai, the whole from River Nile to Jordan. They took over Masjid al-Aqsa. The first thing they did as soon as they entered Masjid al-Aqsa is on the Qubbat al-Sakhra, they put a flag of Israel. It is said they started shouting slogans, revenge for Khaybar, revenge for Khaybar. The deen, the religion of Muhammad is dead. This was the slogan of the day. The rabbi, the chief rabbi of Israel came to Moshe Dayan and said, let's blow up Masjid al-Aqsa now. And this is the time to build our temple. Dayan turned to him and said, if you do not stop, I will get you arrested. Not because Dayan had a love for Muslim or Masjid al-Aqsa, but he knew that the reason he had won was because he was fighting a nationalist country surrounding him. If he had blown Masjid al-Aqsa, it would unite the Ummah. And to fight the Ummah would be different to fight the nation state. And that is the only one reason today even my service. That if the Ummah stands united, and if it shows the love and devotion towards Masjid al-Aqsa Haramain, we would be an obstacle to their destruction. It is no other nation, no other nation state that Israel fears. It is the Ummah that it fears. And these all little examples we see throughout the world. The Muslims are provoked, where their holy sites are being destroyed. The Israeli measure the response of the Ummah. And that is why whatever happens wherever in the world to the Muslims, it is important for the Ummah to rise up and go to the aid, help and assistance of the Muslims. So that we send a signal to those people who are trying to destroy some of our holiest sites. Now, the Israeli, this 1967 war killed over 13,500 Arabs. 6,000 Arabs were taken as prisoners. And on the Israeli side, only 7, to be absolutely specific, this is IDF, Israeli Defense Force figures, only 779 people were killed. This shows that they were well prepared. They had programmed and planned this invasion. Israel now embodied the greatest part of Palestine. They had occupied everything. One thing to remember that when in 1947, Israel, after the Israeli war, immediately the United States of America accepted the state of Israel. However, what they occupied in the 1967 war, which what they call West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the United Nations and America did not accept. And a UN resolution was passed called UN Resolution 242, which basically states that the land that was occupied in 1967 is illegal because this is international law, and Israel must withdraw as soon as possible. And that was in 67. And we're still waiting for a UN resolution to be implemented against Israel till today. And we know what happens when some of Muslim, so-called Muslim leaders, or rather used Arab leaders, flout UN resolutions. They get bombed for 10 years. This is the disparity we live. This is the justice of democracy and international institutions. Now, the Israelis didn't just stop at killing Arabs or Palestinians. At this time, at the 1967 war, there was a USS ship in the Mediterranean. Now, it was recording everything that was taking place. Now, the Israelis are so hell-bent. When they have a project, they do not see who it is. This USS ship, it was called the Liberty, was circled by Israeli Air Force. They recognized it as an American plane, and they bombed it. They bombed it so many times that they sunk the ship with all the intelligence that they had gathered. They killed, I think, 34 people, 171 were injured, and this was the greatest maritime disaster for the Americans since the Second World War, and it was carried out by the Israelis against the Americans. The survivors of USS Liberty, even today, are fighting for compensation, and those who want to visit their website, it's quite interesting that there's a group within America who tries to bring the Israeli actions against them to international court, but the American establishment has forgotten about that. They do not care. The Palestinians now, in 1967, those who had come from 48 and moved into the 67 area now become refugees for the second time. The 700,000 Palestinians who had moved from the 513 villages we talked about had either moved to what was then West Bank and Gaza, or some had gone into refugee camps. Now, for the second time after the occupation, they've been moved out again into refugee camps. A figure of between 250 to 400,000 has been quoted of refugees. These refugees today add up to approximately 5 million people. There's approximately 5 million Palestinian refugees alive today, numbers. These refugees are the longest serving, literally serving a sentence, refugees in the world. There is no other community that can say that they have served as refugees for this long. And why? This is because of the weakness of the Ummah. The Israelis, in order to consolidate their position, they had, again, lots of slogans, and one of their slogans was, there is no meaning of Israel, there is no meaning of the Jewish people without the state of Israel, there is no meaning of Israel without Jerusalem, and there is no meaning of Jerusalem without the Temple of Solomon. And where does the Temple of Solomon go? On the site of Masjid al-Aqsa. And this has been their slogan. Their aim, eventually, is to blow and break Masjid al-Aqsa. Immediately after the occupation in 1967, 2 years later in 1969, a fundamentalist Australian who was being trained in a kibbutz started a fire in Masjid al-Aqsa. He burned the whole southern wing of Masjid al-Aqsa. More than that, the minbar that was commissioned by Nuruddin several hundred years back, and that was put by Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, was burned down by him. The great symbol of Islam was destroyed and put down to ashes. While the fire was going, the Israelis made sure that they had turned the taps off of water so that we could no water supply to quench the fire. The fire that raged in 1969 took 20, the Palestinian brothers, it took them 20 years to repair. That means until 1979, we were all alive, if you do not. We all, and I am included first and foremost here, we should ask ourselves, what did we do for the restoration of Masjid al-Aqsa? The third holiest site in Muslims. This consolidated the position of the Jews, and now the status of what happened in 1667 is what exists up to today. Inshallah, I'll end here today, and we'll carry on, if Allah wills, next week, from 1967 onwards. Jazakallah khair. Mullah. Since we have a tradition of Mulan, we'll be Thank you.